As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to a special Ask Us Anything edition of Glad Tidings, your dedicated Everton FC podcast from The Athletic, with me, Greg O'Keefe, and Paddy Boyland. We're opening today's podcast, plenty on the run-in and players coming back to fitness, the inevitable transfer questions, and you're not just worried about the players, a bunch of other random topics you asked about, including whether Everton are night owls or early birds, and whether that actually matters. You can subscribe to Athletic UK right now for a special price of £3.99 a month for 6 months. That's 40% of the full price of subscription. You'll get to enjoy all the great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all our podcasts. And if you've already got a subscription or you know someone who has, you might well have heard about an interview on The Athletic today with none other than Carlo Ancelotti. Our colleague Adam Crafton had a very in-depth chat with Everton's manager about all things from his views on the proposals for European Super League, to training at Finch Farm, to, well, pretty much a very, very in-depth chat. Loads of interesting stuff in there. And I think more than anything, what comes across is just how much Carlo Ancelotti enjoys being at Everton. So a really good read. Don't forget to check that out. Go to theathletic.com/EvertonPod. Take advantage of this special 40% discount. That's theathletic.com/EvertonPod. Right, on with the questions. Before that, I should just quickly say afternoon to Mr. Boyland, who's on the quieter end of the docks today. He's not got a construction site outside of his window. Are you all right, Pad?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm not bad. It does feel a little bit as though Liverpool is a construction site at the moment. Everywhere I go, roads are blocked off and there's kind of diggers digging things up. I guess recent developments with Bramley Moor have added to that sense a little bit. We're obviously not at the point where we can see spades on the ground quite yet. I'm sure we'll get onto that later. But that is in the offing. We've obviously, since we last recorded, we've moved another step, big step closer with the news that the government are not going to call in for further scrutiny the scheme. So that was fantastic news to get last Friday. Feels like a long time ago, but fantastic news, and really, really looking forward to seeing this progress now from where it is.
Glad you said that. 6 days later, it does feel like a lot longer. Time in lockdown continues to do strange things, doesn't it? It's either really, really fast or really, really slow. Anyway, let's get on with the question, because there's plenty of them, and you did respond emphatically to Paddy's tweet earlier, so thank you very much for that. Everyone who sent in a question, if we don't get around to yours, we apologise in advance, but please do take part in future Q&As, because we'll look to get a really wide spread of different questions. So let's start with Sam Mason, and he says, what does Gbamin's reintroduction look like from here? Do you think we could realistically see him start a game before the end of the season? Well, my initial thoughts was that I would hope so, because he's been training. Paddy spoke to, well, you may have read Paddy's piece I think was it last year now, Pat, when you spoke to some of the people that he'd been, some specialists that, that Jean-Philippe had been training with over in France, as advised to get back fit. There's a feeling, isn't there, that, you know, he is, we are going to see him, aren't we, Pat? We are going to see him in an Everton shirt on the pitch soon.
Yeah, I think we will do. Obviously, it's been a very cautious approach from Everton up to now. As I wrote in that piece earlier this year, as it happened, he was working with a personal trainer in France, in Paris, until around December last year. And since then, he's been working his way back to full fitness over here, so he could eventually reintegrate back into full training. Great over the international break when things are quite quiet to see him not only back at Finch Farm, but also step things up an extra gear and train with the first team. There was a video put out last Friday by the club where they showed him in those kind of small-sided training games that Everton play so often, actually, at Finch Farm. Everton will continue to be cautious, and I think rightly so. What they don't want to do is rush the lad back prematurely, because I'm thinking there's a feeling that another big setback, not necessarily a muscular injury, but a re-injury of the Achilles tendon or the quadriceps, could prove quite damaging as far as Gbamin's concerned, not just from a physical perspective, but also mentally. So I think they will continue to be really cautious with him. The good news is he's back in training. The good news is that he's back in contact training. He's tackling, he's passing, he's running, all those kinds of things on the grass. So there has been progress over the last few weeks. And I think Ancelotti's always maintained throughout, even when we didn't see Gbamin at Finch Farm, he's always maintained that there was a chance that there could be reintegration and there could be game time before the end of the season. And nothing that I've seen over the last few weeks would contradict that. I wouldn't expect him to start against Crystal Palace by any stretch of the imagination. I wouldn't even expect to see him in the squad necessarily. I think Everton will take their time. But would I rule out him playing before the end of the season? Absolutely not. And that'd be cracking. I think the goal is to get him reintegrated now and then to make sure he's ready for a full pre-season and to hit the ground running next season. I think that's the big challenge for him. I don't know, what do you think?
Well, maybe I'm being foolishly optimistic, but I almost think that I think realistically speaking, you're right. But also, I think, given there's, what, 9 games left, you'd like to hope he can have a meaningful contribution to at least, say, like, let's say, the last sort of 4 or 5 of them. Now, that is without, obviously, you've got to allow for time to be readjust or effectively adjust all over again to playing in the Premier League at the pace and everything like that. So maybe 5 games worth of impact is a stretch. But I still think that he's got to nearly prove himself all over again and prove that, you know, he's the player that Marcel Brands thought he was, and that there show signs that he can be a part of the squad next season, almost to allay having to think about addressing that area with another signing in the summer. So I think it's going to be, it'll be more than just, there'll be something meaningful about his return. I'm not going to expect him to be 100%, and you're right, the focus will inevitably be on seeing the real Gbamin probably next season. Any player needs time to adjust, don't they? But especially when he's gone through what he's gone through. But on the flip side, at least we know he's had a long time living in this country. He knows his teammates. So, he will have done some of the off-the-pitch adjustments, really, in that period of time. Let's hope he can have a tangible impact on our sort of fight to get into the top 5 or 6.
I think that's quite an interesting point that you made there when you were talking about what he needs to do himself to almost prove to Ancelotti he can be an option moving forward. What you've got to remember is he is still effectively a new player as far as Everton are concerned. He's had 135 minutes of football, which is 1.5 games. And he's not really played in a match context with most of his teammates. Some of them are new to him, completely new. So it's gonna. We've had lockdown. It's gonna take a while. But that's a really interesting point about him impressing and improving himself, because it's obviously fairly recently Ancelotti said that they are looking at midfield potentially for the summer, and that would be very much dependent on how people like Gbamin and Delph go in this period and over pre-season. So if they don't perform or they don't stay fit, then of course there is a chance that Everton will look to that part of the pitch for strengthening over the summer, and that would be quite interesting. I actually still think that they're short in that area. I think they need more ball playing quality and more energy in there regardless. Let's hope somebody like Gbamin can be the one to bring that.
Well, that feeds into the next couple of questions, really. Certainly, Jonathan Smith wants to know which players do you think the club will be actively trying to find exits for in a neighbour's squad rationalisation. So we're talking about bringing players potentially in. Jonathan's thinking about players sort of going the other way, really. And then, to an extent, the Pieman's got a similar question. Admittedly, he's a controversial one, only because I like a good debate. Is DCL's all-round game good enough to lead the line and ultimately fulfil our ambitions? I guess I'm talking about his play outside the six-yard box yard. Or conversely, is Richarlison's? If not, do we cash in on one of them? He did say it was controversial. So let's quickly look at Jonathan first, you know, in the name of squad rationalisation. What a romantic concept. Do you think the club will be actively trying to find exits for certain players?
Yeah, I think they absolutely have to. You look at the model over the last few years and what we know about financial fair play constraints, and obviously they could change in a sense, but Everton still do need to be careful. They do need to bring in money through transfers and transfers out of the club in particular. So I look at somebody like John Joe Kenny, who will come back from his loan at Celtic over the summer, and he'll only have, I think, is it 1 year left on his deal at that point?
Yeah.
If he's not going to sign a new deal, and there's no sign that one is forthcoming at the moment, I should point out, then he's a sellable asset. He's somebody you need to get off the books quite soon. Bernard nearly went in January, obviously a high earner, so that's a continuation from the winter. Cenk Tosun will come back. He's only on loan. Can they find a club for Cenk Tosun? Theo Walcott should leave anyway because he's out of contract. I don't think it would be a huge surprise if he wasn't retained. And then it's trimming around the fringes, getting moved for whoever you can. I might have missed somebody out there, maybe, but they're the ones that really stick out to me.
Just Palazzi, but you know, I think it's clear that he will go, won't he? You know, he'd be a permanent deal. Or am I losing the plot? Did he go in January? I forget where his current status is. He's had that many loans.
Yeah, Middlesbrough on loan.
I forget where he is in terms of, is he still our player or not?
he is just about, yeah. Where is he geographically? He's in Middlesbrough, yeah. But Balassi's another one. He's going to have a future Mo Besic.
Yeah, absolutely. As well. There's a few there. Just have a quick point on what Pieman was asking. Basically, I suppose he's just saying, for debating sake, do we need to look at maybe trying to cash in on either DCL or Charleston? I would just frankly say no. I think if you want to progress, you need both of them in your squad. And so I think the harder will be trying to keep hold of them both, but looking to try and cash in on them because following his suggested logic, you think you can do better. I don't see Everton attracting better at the moment, unless, you know, things change and they get in the top four. But I wouldn't have thought they were two players that you were looking to move on because of deficiencies in their game. Although I admit neither is perfect. I'm not saying that, but I wouldn't have thought you actually to be looking to move them on.
They're some of the stronger parts of this Everton team. When you strip out somebody like a Richarlison or a Calvert-Lewin, Everton suffer and are weaker for it. I'm not suggesting that you'd strip them out and not bring somebody else in, but
yeah,
why? Unless you absolutely had to, unless you had to sell somebody, or unless somebody really wanted to go, why would you purposely weaken that part of the pitch, a stronger part of the pitch? I'd be looking at weaker areas as it is and going, can we do something at right back? Can we do something central midfield? Can we maybe do something on the wings to add a kind of an injection of pace? I wouldn't be, where possible, I wouldn't be looking to overhaul, really.
Certainly not. County Road Bobblers and Alan Robertson asked similar questions. That sort of County Road Bobblers ask, is there anyone you think we could buy that might not be the most overwhelming deal, but would really boost the squad overall? And then they suggest Daniel James as someone who, you know, might not be a staggering signing, probably a la James Rodriguez, but they think would boost the squad. And then Alan Robinson says, name three new feasible players you would like to see in Everton's first game of next season. So, interesting one, really. Daniel James, he's a good player. It's a good one. It's a good question, really, Daniel James. What do you think? Would he have a place? Does he get into Everton's first team?
He's actually playing for Manchester United a fair bit at the moment.
Yeah, he is. He's playing a lot more recently, hasn't he, than he did sort of start of the season.
Carved a bit of a niche as this workhorse on the right flank. Mm. Trouble insides on the counter-attack with his pace. I think he's all right. I think there's an issue there over end product, to be honest. I'm not seeing a lot of evidence from him at Premier League level that he's able to score and set up goals in the way that you maybe would have wanted. But I think what the question speaks to, potentially, is a lack of something in the Everton squad. And for me, that's pace. I mean, if we are effectively saying that Richarlison is now, in Ancelotti parlance, he's a centre-left forward, and we're moving him away from a position on the left wing, then what wingers do Everton actually have? Because we've already spoken about today, you'd expect Walcott and Bolasie. They're 99.9% likely to leave over the summer. Bernard, his future's up in the air, but I don't know, do you even really class him as a winger? To me, he's...
Absolutely not, he's
certainly not in the old school sense. Alex Iwobi, I think he probably sees his position as a number 10, but he can fill in wide areas. So do Everton actually have any wingers? I don't know. Certainly not after the summer. So I would look at that position, maybe not Daniel James as such, but I would look at that position and think to myself, Everton do need to strengthen. Everton do need something more. Everything seems to be in front of the opposition at the moment. I think you need those runners breaking behind to give James a bit more space in the midfield and a few others a bit more space in the midfield. Not sold on Daniel James, but on board with the concept of pace and extra width.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Neil Spuddy, 1878. Funny question, Matt. Will Carlo Ancelotti be in for a new goalkeeper in the summer? Well, I mean, look, a lot of it depends, I suppose. There was strong talk that Robin Olsen might be looking, that they might be looking to make Robin Olsen's loan permanent. Now, although the situation hasn't seemingly changed, or we haven't had confirmation the situation's changed, there have been several things that, you know, he's had injuries. There was the horrendous break-in at his house in great, you know, sort of Cheshire, Manchester way, which may have sort of left him being unsettled. And he still may well become, you know, he still may well become the permanent sort of deputy slash competitor for the number one shirt. But I almost wonder if Carlo would be looking for an even more compelling option. What do you think?
Well, he was looking for a more compelling option in January. He didn't go to Robin Olsen straight away. Obviously, we reported at the time that he liked the look of particularly Sergio Romero at Manchester United.
Yeah, that's right.
Paolo Gazzaniga at Tottenham was another one that they kind of had a little bit of a look at. And then when those two moves failed, then they had a look at Robin Olsen, who was kind of pretty readily available after dropping down the pecking order at Roma. Ancelotti's being pretty happy with Olsen. All things considered, he wanted to bring in his own man to push Pickford, who is still undisputed number one. and I think for all intents and purposes would have been quite happy to extend Olsen's stay at Goodison. So let's see how that one goes. In answer to Neil's question, yes, I think he will look to bring in a goalkeeper, whether it's Robin Olsen or somebody else. If it's a different question, if what Neil is actually asking is, do Everton need a proper new number one? Then I think that's harder to answer. And I don't know about you, but I've not seen any evidence yet to suggest that confidence has completely dwindled in Jordan Pickford. And the other thing I'd point out as well is that even if you wanted to bring in a new number one ahead of Jordan Pickford, how would you shift somebody like Pickford on? Because his stock's not where it was after the last World Cup, where he was performing heroics. This seems tougher. So I would expect movement in the goalkeeping department, but I don't know if it would necessarily be a revolution as such, to use kind of a Carlo Ancelotti term, more evolution if we're going Partridge style.
Yeah, interesting. He keeps his cards so close to chest on Pickford, doesn't he? But there's certainly been no indication on or off the record that he's ready to look for a new permanent number one. Yes, we'll see what comes of that. Matters more on the pitch in terms of the fourth, you know, as well, the future really. Peter McColl wants to know, with the run-in coming, traditionally we tend to end the season strong, and what hurdles do we face? So I mean, he's looking at that really, kind of some winnable games, but we don't know what are winnable games at the moment for Everton, do we? But what hurdles do we face? Well, we were talking before we started recording, there's some big games on a Friday, even if they're starters, that are going to be really difficult, aren't they?
Yeah, so the fixtures have changed fairly recently for April, and Everton face Tottenham at home and Arsenal away in that calendar month, both on Friday night. Both, don't quote me on this, but 8 o'clock kickoffs, I think, around 8 o'clock at least. They're tough games, really tough games, because effectively they are going to be direct competitors as far as the fight for Europe is concerned. It's not the worst fixture list in the world, but it's equally not the easiest that they could have had either. I look at, one of the big questions for me is how they cope with the absence of Abdoulaye Doucouré. We've spoken on past shows about Doucouré's ability to just fill in and plug gaps all over the pitch.
Yeah.
Whether it be providing a bit of energy from midfield going forward, breaking the lines, or if it's, I don't know, running into the right back channel to cover for James in the early part of the season. He's very good. He's positionally intelligent. And I think without him, Everton lack energy and lack a bit of that positional intelligence. Mm. So how do they cope without him? Can they keep other players fit? I think there's obviously, as we've mentioned before, a massive reliance on James Rodriguez. He's missed an awful lot of football, but is on his way back now and potentially could play against Crystal Palace. Are they able to keep him fit for the final 10 games of the season? Because if they are, Everton's chances of getting into Europe, I would suggest, rise exponentially. They go right up, shoot up. So I think it's about managing the squad, making sure that they get through in one piece.
Yeah.
The closer they are to their full strength 11, the greater the chance, obviously, that they have. And we saw in the early part of the season what they can be like at the very best. I loved watching them for that opening 6, 7, 8 games, where they were just tearing teams apart with kind of wonderful free flow and attack and football.
Yeah, didn't we all? Yeah,
we've moved away from that. So I think it's a tough fixture list. Keep players fit, they've got a chance of probably an outside chance of getting into the Europa League. I don't know what you think.
I feel as if the Champions League is pretty much gone. But I think keep those players fit and get Rodriguez's influence consistent and back, then I think they'll get the points that they need. And Paul Fortenberry and Matthew Barry asked similar questions, really, and I would just say that what Paddy said, I agree with it, just kind of goes hand in hand with that. It's going to be luck with injuries and making sure that they can get Rodriguez on the pitch as much as possible. Joe Lee Dowd has got an interesting question. He says he saw the Athletic stats earlier in the week about us having the league's second or third lowest proportion of touches in the opposition third all season. What's the deal with that, he asks. We can't seem to attack properly and create non-cross chances anymore, especially without Rodriguez. It's funny because we were literally just saying that, really, weren't we? Those halcyon days of September, you know, when we were tearing teams apart with that 4-3-3. Things have changed, haven't they, really, with that?
We've had these discussions ourselves, haven't we, in private, Greg, where we've because the fixture list has been so congested, we've gone to games and effectively it becomes, what do you write about? What's the theme from this match as the match piece? What are you going to cover? And so often, particularly in some of these home games, the trap is set for you. You can fall very easily back into, effectively, Everton are not very good in possession. And there's a massive onus on James Rodriguez in particular to create chances from open play.
Yeah.
The big question mark for me is, what do they do when they don't establish that aerial dominance? They're great when Luka Dean's fizzing in crosses and Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison are attacking them. Against sides that can't stand up to that, Everton look $1 million and look like they can score basically all the time.
Yeah.
But there are multiple sides in the league. Any David Moyes team, just off the top of my head, they're going to be able to defend crosses all day. Even some of the garbage in the league, the dross, the likes of Newcastle, they've got people like Jamal Lascelles who will lap that kind of service up all day. I've not yet seen, beyond maybe the first four or five games, I've not yet seen a sustainable way of creating chances. And I don't actually think Everton managed the ball very well at all. So it remains to be seen whether they can improve on that with the current personnel. James will improve it a bit. But I would look at it in the summer and I'd almost say, are they able to get somebody that dictates? I was just thinking the other day, I'd love them to have a new version of Gareth Barry. Do you remember like 13, 14 Gareth Barry that just sits in front and he's just great at orchestrating play? I feel as though they miss that kind of metronome. They don't really have it and they've struggled to get the ball up the pitch at times.
No, so. I agree. Shouldn't Alan sort of be capable of doing that?
Possibly.
It's a rhetorical question because, of course, possibly you should, but he doesn't do it. You're right, we do miss that type of player massively.
I don't see enough guile from this Everton side yet, and obviously we've written quite a lot effectively along the lines of there's a correlation between the more possession Everton have and the amount of defeats they have. So if they, when they have above 65% possession, they tend to lose most of the games they play. But when they have below 30% possession, they tend to win most of those matches. So they're just better simply at the moment as an outfit that defends, that creates a couple of moments and keeps things tight.
Yeah.
And then they hope to nick things. I would like to see more than that beyond the summer, by the way.
Well, he's got to evolve that, hasn't he? Because that's no way to progress up the table in the long run. Roger Cropper wants to know what our impressions of King has been so far. From the outside, it looks like a disappointing signing with little minutes on the pitch so far. Not likely to sign permanently in the summer as it stands, ? I did a piece last week, week before last, about Joshua King, which sort of addressed these points, really. Although, obviously, there's still a portion of the season left, so we will see whether or not he gets the opportunity. I think he's been a little bit unlucky to a degree, in terms of Richarlison playing back into goal-scoring form. And Ancelotti is obviously unlikely to break those up in terms of starting 11. Now, your limited minutes on the pitch, I would agree with, but he's come on in most games. Hasn't been enough, again, I agree with. And it's been up and down, what we've seen from him. Although, in fairness to him, he's come on in games quite often when we're losing. The best performance was arguably against Fulham, or Chelsea, to be fair. Again, we lost. So, I'm not convinced so far, but I don't think it's entirely on him. What have you made of Joshua King so far?
I think it's been disappointing. It depends who you want to blame for that, really. We reported over the summer that he was somebody that Everton were looking at, along with a host of clubs, in fairness, because he only had 12 months at that point left on his deal.
Yeah.
So he's not somebody that they've just plucked out of nowhere. They've scouted him for a while and have known about him for a while. I would have expected, with that in mind, I would have expected this loan to have been slightly more profitable up to now. The odd goal here or there. I don't think anybody can be expected to come in and completely hit the ground running in a new side and maybe displace for Charles and Calvert-Lewin from the outset, score 5, 6, 7 goals. He's not going to be like the new Kevin Campbell for Everton, who came obviously in that famous season from Trabzonspor and bagged that glut of goals. I think that's beyond players, really, in the main. That was a legendary feat from Campbell. But you'd have expected something. We've not seen that, and obviously Ancelotti's not seen that, if he's not given him enough opportunities to play. I'd like to see him get a chance here or there to see what show what he can do. But there have been games when Everton have been missing players and he still hasn't really got on the pitch. So yeah, disappointing. And at one point, I'd have looked at that and gone, if Everton could acquire him for a budget fee over the summer, as was originally mooted, then that probably would have been a good bit of business. But you'd have to suggest that because things have been slow up to now, the chances of him extending his time at Goodison must have decreased. That I'm just talking logically here, by the way, rather than based on any info. He's not done anything to earn a permanent move at the moment, has he?
No, he hasn't. And that's circumstantially, they've got the cover they need. And if that's all it comes down to, then, you know, maybe they both shake hands at the end of the period and say, you know, let's call it a day. You know, he served the purpose and Everton did for him. But well, I suppose they will have done if he gets a few more games, because he wanted to keep. I think the impression I got from speaking to people who know him is that he wants to be playing football. He probably hasn't done as much of that as he'd liked, in fairness. So we'll see. He's got options as well, I would say, to Roger, there are clubs who want to take him in this country and in Europe. So maybe that's a case of they might well go separate ways.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Gano asks, are the club trying to improve the pathway to the first team for youngsters, as we've only had limited players make the step up recently? And I suppose even that, and I'm adding this to, you know, for the debate's sake, even that has been in and out in terms of Brandt Braith and Anthony Gordon. You know, there's been fresh speculation about Siri Small's situation with, you know, obviously he's shown his potential for the 18s and 23s and seemingly really keen to be playing the first team, but there's quite a significant of buttress in front of him in terms of Lucas Dean, and then that's not even forgetting Niels and Kunku. But maybe the case in point is Tyler Onyango, been on the bench a lot, not really featured. So I think there is a real pathway. I mean, they talk about the pathway a lot, but I suppose ultimately Ancelotti doesn't tend to be as willing to play young players as perhaps previous managers have been.
You can talk all day, can't you, about pathways and the amount of players you have on the bench, but if the guy at the top decides not to play them, then it's all moot, really. And I think Ancelotti at the moment would much rather, let's say, for example, if he was given the option in an injury crisis of playing Tyler Onyango or dropping Gylfi Sigurdsson deeper, playing Andre Gomez, Tom Davis, he's going to favour the more experienced player 9 times out of 10, potentially even 10 times out of 10, if we're being frank. So I think below him, Marcel Brand certainly has been focused on this quite a lot. I've written quite a lot, I feel, over the last few months about this idea of getting a sustainable structure in place and getting players promoted up earlier. So obviously, Ellis Sims, Jared Branthwaite, Anthony Gordon all went out on loan in January for extra game time. That freed up spaces on the first team bench. It freed up spaces in the under-23s as well for under-18s players. And then because the under-18s are in the under-23s, under-16s go into the under-18s. So I kind of feel as though they are starting to make headway with that pathway. Mm. They are getting to where they need to be. But that's going to be a process over an extended period of time to get anywhere close to where it needs to be. Things don't happen overnight in that regard. We are starting to see some signs of it now. But ultimately, like you say, are those kids good enough? And at the end of the day, is Ancelotti going to play them? Because they're going to have to be very, very good to get in a side with aspirations of European football. Up to now, he's not bit the bullet, has he?
He hasn't, no. Even when, you know, you could sort of like in quite a, I suppose, quite a reductive manner. You could just look at it and say, well, Onyango is big and long legs and can get up and down the pitch. You know, oh, we're lacking that player in Gakure being injured. Surely he should get a go. But the same old Ancelotti is watching these players in training. And I think I would trust his opinion on whether they're ready.
Yeah.
But what that means for the wider pathway, it's a good question. Ultimately, I suppose Everton are a club. Ancelotti is here to help Everton take the next step and win things and get into Europe and compete in Europe, as opposed to perhaps, and there will be a bit of this, and this is where Marcel Brands's kind of role, as opposed to producing young players who can ultimately, if not become first team players and save Everton a lot of money, can then become pros and cash Everton money from elsewhere, moving on. But giving them the time to do it doesn't necessarily fit into whether or not, you know, his desire to move Everton forward. So there's going to be a bit of friction there, I think. And not easy. It's not easy at all. But I think a lot of big clubs do have a lot of young players who end up going out on loan perpetually. And you just see that with Chelsea and City. So maybe that's down the line what will happen to Everton. And ultimately players may well choose to go and play elsewhere. A similar question really from Everton Viking. But onto the Bramley Moor Stadium, as Pad reminded us earlier, it's almost a week since we got the fantastic news that Robert Jenrick, the community secretary, isn't going to call in stadium plans, effectively therefore endorsing the planning permission, which has already been passed unanimously by Liverpool Council. So there we go. No more, certainly no more major obstacles in the way. Historic England effectively seem to have removed their objection, or certainly indicated they weren't going to appeal. Now it's just a case of certain things falling into place, money, they've got to announce their funding partner. And then it comes to Tom Chalmers' question, when can we expect the first spade in the ground of Bramley Moor? And Graham the Traveller and Matthew Neal asked similar questions, as I'm sure many Blues want to know. When can we expect to see some work starting? Looking like, I know it's a little bit vague, but it's looking like the summer, isn't it?
Yeah, so when we spoke to the club around the last announcement, they were saying spring or summer. I'd suggest it's probably summer now, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're already in April, and there are still a few hurdles to overcome, particularly just getting this signed off legally, more than anything. Obviously, permission's been given, but there's procedures to go through, the paperwork to be completed, legislation to sign, all that kind of stuff. Like you say, they've obviously made progress with funding partners, and that shouldn't be a massive issue, but they need to get it all signed off. And yeah, they said spring or summer. I'd probably say summer at the moment is looking more realistic, potentially.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, there's an awful lot of initial work to be done on the site as well before, so which you could probably class as a spade in the ground, but it might not be, you know, huge diggers and cranes on site. It might be, as they call it, remedial work to prepare the dock for the process, because it's such a unique, you know, project in many ways. The process of being infilled in parts and then getting it ready to then start to build the foundations and then skeleton the stadium. But yeah, later in the summer, I would hope for. And then the next step is just to get the confirmation that the funding partner's in place, and I expect it to be a good deal, in all honesty. There were some moans and groans and questions about Premier League, and some were really interesting. Actually, Upper Gladys Blue wanted to know, do you think it bothers the manager and the team that 20 out of 22 league games from December through April have all been night games? I'm thinking, he says, in terms of recovery time, sleep after games. It's not the norm to play virtually all your games at night. Do you think it's had an adverse effect? An interesting question. There have been more night games. It feels like that's probably, but I would suggest, I don't know this for a fact, but I see what you think, but a lot of that's because the glut of fixtures with COVID and the nature of the season and fitting them all in for the broadcast purposes. How much of an effect it has, I'm not sure. What do you think, Pat?
It's interesting he mentions having a moan, effectively, because I know that I like to have a moan about this. It's something that annoys me a lot, and that I often vent about on social media in one form or another. I did after the latest fixture list announcements. Just like he says, this kind of repetitive pattern of night games and what that means with regards to working hours and everything else. Recovery is an interesting point too, because it inevitably means that, let's say, for example, you play on a Sunday night and you've got another game on Wednesday. You have less time to prepare and to recover. Players normally get at least one day off after some of these games. So you're eating into the week, really, before you, substantially into the week before you're doing your base work for the next match, your tactical work, stuff on the training ground, all that kind of stuff, your video analysis. So I don't think the fixture list has always been particularly kind to Everton. They seem to have had a disproportionate amount of night games. The context, like you say, is very much that with COVID the way it is at the moment, certainly the way it has been, I think the Premier League are trying to space the games out over the course of 3-4 days over the weekend. So there are loads of different slots being used, and Everton have been unlucky, in quotation marks, that they've had all these games over this period. Mm. I've not heard any grumbling. Carlo Ancelotti's not the kind of guy that really grumbles to the media about anything, really. He's rarely moaned about the injury list, even though we know it's been pretty heavy at times for Everton this season, still is, in reality. He's not really done that. He's not the kind of guy that really has moans and gripes. He gets on with the job, and maybe behind the scenes people will speak their mind a bit more. I don't know, but I've not heard of much. What I would say is I don't think anybody is going to be happy from a recovery point of view with this amount of late games. I wouldn't be in their position.
No, I agree. It's not ideal. It can't be optimal in terms of how you want your season to go. And there does seem to be more than ever. But I do quite like that Ancelotti's doesn't tend to look for excuses. It's us poor journalists. I worry about Pat. You know, what about our recovery? A lot of coffee being drunk on the morning after these night games when we're filing these pieces, let me tell you that. Right. Yeah, Craig Lloyd asked a similar question actually about fixtures and how much input the club have for the Premier League.
Not much.
Not much at all, really. It's more the Premier League and the broadcasters, isn't it? Especially the way it is at the moment, I think.
Yeah.
Feels that way for a while. The club often gets stuff presented to them as a fait accompli. We've moved it to 5 o'clock on a Friday. And that's been a long-standing pattern, hasn't it, in terms of fans getting the raw end of the deal.
I think you only have to look back to the festive period and the game that was called off against Manchester City. Now, I'm not apportioning any blame here, but Everton didn't feel as though they were part of the decision-making process.
Exactly.
And that's why they responded so vehemently by their own standards. We know that they normally like to keep their powder dry. They normally like to be the elder statesman in the room. Quite right, too, in most cases. But they weren't happy with that because it felt as though the decision had been made by Manchester City, rightly or wrongly, in conjunction with the Premier League.
Yeah.
Responded negatively, so I think that gives you an insight into where the balance of power is. I think the broadcasters, because of the way situation is at the moment, because of the money they pay, because of the loss of kind of certain things to do with atmosphere and things that improve a broadcast, I think they have an awful lot of power, maybe now more than ever before. So they can largely dictate things on their terms.
Yeah, that's true, especially now at the moment. They can indeed. And then just one last question from some really interesting ones is from the amusingly named Kirky Worky. And he says, to mark 20 years since his debut, which is an interesting anniversary, actually, I didn't think of that. What is Tony Ebert's greatest performance in a blue shirt? 8 years since his debut. Tony Ebert's greatest performance in a blue shirt. I mean, he was a throwback as a fullback, you know, wasn't he? Back to the days when there was more of an emphasis put on defensive, you know, tackles, blocks, stopping, but, you know, more, well, we know at the attacking side of the modern game wasn't his strong suit. And we know that he probably wouldn't have been what is needed in this era of wing backs, but he was a fantastic defender, wasn't he? And a really, really loyal servant to the club.
Yeah, well, as everybody knows, he obviously didn't score a competitive goal for Everton, so we can't really talk about wonderful buccaneering attacking displays. I do remember him. It was at the 4-4 at Old Trafford where Everton rallied and got a late draw. I remember him putting at least one cross. In fact, I think he got two assists that day. One for Jelovic and maybe another in the second half for either Jelovic or Fellaini. I'd need to check that again. He was good that day in an attacking sense. But more than anything with Hibbert, I remember him just being the guy that you wanted to face down the tricky opposition winger. He did it like when Manchester City had Martin Petrov and they were just kind of a coming force in the game.
Yeah.
I was really worried about Martin Petrov that day because I thought he's rinsing everybody at the moment, this guy.
Yeah.
And Hibbert just had him in his pocket. He wasn't the first winger that he did that to.
Yeah.
And I think that he was a throwback, as you say, and I think that was because, remember Gary Neville saying that around that time, a lot of fullbacks were failed centre halves, for want of a better analogy. And it was very much maybe you were too small to play centre half, but you had good defensive instinct, so you'd shift across to right back.
Yeah.
And really, what all you were expected to do was go one on one with the opposition fullback, opposition winger, and win your individual battles, particularly in a defensive sense. You weren't expected to be a playmaker or a creator or set up goals. I think Ashley Cole kind of changed that, or he was one of the first that changed that, because he was the guy that he'd played early on in his youth career as a striker, a forward, a left winger, but Arsenal dropped him back. And that's when the role of the fullback sort of started to change. All of a sudden they went from being failed centre-halves to being, well, from failed wingers to fullbacks. And he was just a little bit caught in that maelstrom, I think. Tony Hibbert, he was a very good defender, but he didn't add much often in an attacking sense. What I would say, he was a fantastic servant for Everton. Really, really good. Top pro. You covered the club in more depth than I did in those days, Greg, so you'll know more than me. But he was never really one to talk to the media, was he? He kind of kept his powder dry. And now...
Yeah.
And now after football, he's got his a fishery, hasn't he, out in rural France?
He's into
carping and stuff like that.
Embracing his love of fishing. Yeah, you're right. He wasn't one for doing much media. He didn't really. Nothing. He was never rude. He just didn't enjoy that at all, and would find novel ways to try and avoid it. And I always chuckle when I remember him once coming through the mix zone, and it was at United actually, and. It might have even been after that 4-4. Funny enough, Brad, when you're right, he did have a stormer of a game. And he was coming through the mixer, and I was waiting to try and get him to stop for a rare interview. And he was on his phone, which obviously, you know, would suggest I can't stop. And as he was walking, his phone started ringing, so he clearly wasn't on his phone at all. He was just trying to... I heard laughter coming from the other end of the mixer, and I suspect one of his teammates may well have... tried to do him up like a kipper. I certainly saw the funny side. And did he stop then? I think he did. I think I think he sort of saw the funny side himself, red-faced, stopped and did 4 minutes of very short and think dances. But that was Tony. Lovely fella. Not a big talker, but a really, really big player for Everton. That part of the Premier League era for Everton. And as you say, defensively, one-on-one as a stopper. In his prime, he was tremendous for the Blues. So nice one to end it with, and thanks for that question, Kirk. Enjoyed that. Thanks for all your questions. Like I say, if we didn't get round to them, we will in future, and we'll try and do this a bit more on the podcast. And once again, I'm just thank you for listening. Wish you all a happy Easter, and speak to you next time.
I like for stalking them in the margins. I think trying to outwit them and get up close, I think I like that.
The Athletic.